The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
I've actually been organizing for 200 years. I know black don't crack, but I'm 32. So I'm very excited to give this talk. It's very momentous. I think the last year has been really transformative, and really when we are in historic moments like this, it's really important for us to kind of go back and learn from past struggles and also have a stronger grasp of kind of the roots and theories of, you know, oppression, where, you know, oppression comes from and why it is that we continue to see the phenomenon of sexual assault and racism that persists today. So, thanks for attending and still being here at 11:30 on the last day. Over the past year, we've thankfully witnessed the growth of a movement against sexual assault, misconduct, and harassment that has been sparked by celebrity women coming out with the experiences of sexual assault at the hands of Hollywood executive Harvey Weinstein. The movement quickly spread through the hashtag MeToo, popularized by actress Alyssa Milano on social media. However, the term MeToo also happened to be the name of the movement founded in 2006 by black feminist and activist Tarana Burke, who's actually from New York City, Bronx, New York City. This movement started on her MySpace platform before hashtags were hashtags. And even within the limits of MySpace, Tarana talked about how quickly so many women kind of came out of, you know, this network, this social media platform, to talk about their experiences of sexual abuse. And she thought, you know, she basically said if there was the Facebook, it would have gone viral. It was like the MySpace version of viral. So Tarana envisioned MeToo as a movement to promote, quote, empowerment through empathy among women of color who had experienced sexual abuse, women and girls of color who had experienced sexual abuse, particularly within low-income communities. As Tarana explained in an interview, MeToo is essentially about survivors supporting survivors. And it's really about community healing and community action, although we can't define with healing what healing looks like for people. We can set the stage and give people the resources to have access to healing, and that means legitimate things like policies and laws that change to support survivors. The movement has been transformative and has created an opening to mobilize against sexual assault and end the silence and shame it breeds. But one of the debates it has also raised is the question of sexual assault among women, black and other women of color, right? When the movement first started, people lamented that it was quote unquote being, you know, co-opted by white rich women in Hollywood. My take is that it's really important that it did happen, and it also showed that women across different racial groups in Hollywood were being sexually harassed, and also these women used your platform. Perhaps they listened to some of these critiques. I think there was good pressure from below, and they used your platform to also support marginalized women, women of color, undocumented immigrants, workers, domestic workers, etc. In general, I mean, this movement has been really incredible, and I think has given us something to hold on to and use to fight back. I think it's an important point, and one with a rich history that offers many important lessons on fighting racism and sexism. Racism and sexual assault, how black women specifically fought back against sexual assault. In this talk, I focus on this historic role black women have played against sexual violence in the US from slavery to the Me Too era, to draw some lessons for the Me Too era. And I argue that we must engage with this history of sexual violence against black women for an understanding of the role rape as a political tool of repression and control of black populations, the role that has played, as well as using this history to draw lessons for our fight back today. I should note that the talk is primarily about rape of black women at the hands of white people, and not on, you know, interracial horizontal rape, and, you know, intraracial and horizontal rape. So Yeah, I want to start with three vignettes, and some of these are long, but I think it's important to hear the stories of rape in these different periods to understand just, you know, how vile, I mean, we know how vile it is, but just to also notice some of the themes across different political periods in rape and how Black women experience rape. So the first one is the story of Harriet Jacobs, an enslaved woman born in 1813 in North Carolina, escaped from her master after years of him systematically raping her. In her narrative titled Incidents in the Life of a Slave Girl, which she wrote under the under a pseudonym, she wrote, "When I entered on my 15th year, a sad epic in the life of a slave girl, my master began to whisper foul words in my ear. Young as I was, I could not remain ignorant of their import. I tried to treat them with indifference or contempt. The master's age, my extreme youth, and the fear that his conduct would be reported to my grandmother made him bear this treatment for many months. He was a crafty man and resorted to many means to accomplish his purposes. Sometimes he had stormy, terrific ways that made him his victims tremble. Sometimes he assumed a gentleness that he thought was truly subdued. He tried his utmost to corrupt the pure principles my grandmother had instilled. He peopled my young mind with unclean images, such as only a vile monster could think of. I turned from him with disgust and hatred, but he was my master. I was compelled to live under the same roof with him, where I saw a man 40 years my senior daily violating the most sacred commandments of nature. He told me I was his property, that I must be subject to his will in all things. My master was, to my knowledge, the father of 11 slaves. But did the mothers dare to tell who was the father of their children? Did the other slaves dare to allude to it, except in whispers among themselves? No, indeed. They knew too well the terrible consequences. My grandmother could not avoid seeing things which excited her suspicions. She was uneasy about me and tried various ways to buy me, but the never-changing answer was always repeated. Linda does not belong to me. She's a daughter's property, and I have no legal right to sell her. The conscientious man, he was too scrupulous to sell me, but he had no scruples whatsoever about committing a much greater wrong against a helpless young girl placed under his guardianship, and as his daughter's property. Sometimes my prosecutor would answer me whether I would like to be sold. My persecutor, excuse me, would ask me whether I would like to be sold. I told him I would rather be sold to anybody than to lead such a life as I did. For my master, whose restless, craven, vicious nature roved about day and night, seeking whom to devour, had just left me with stinging, scorching words, words that scathed ear and brain like fire. Oh, how I despised him. I thought how glad I should be if someday, when he walked the earth, it would open and swallow him up and disencumber him, disencumber the world of a plague. When he told me that I was made for his use, made to obey his command in everything, that I was nothing but a slave, whose will must and should surrender to his, never before had my puny arm felt half so strong. So the second vignette is from the story of Racie Taylor, who you might have heard of during Oprah's, like, is it historic, I guess, speech around. I mean, she was talking about the story in the context of Me Too at the Oscars or the Golden Globes? I'm like, I don't know which of these awards. And she highlighted Racie Taylor's story and connected with it. Oprah herself, a victim of sexual violence. On September 3rd, 1944, 24-year-old African-American mother and sharecropper by the name of Racie Taylor left her church in Abbeville, Alabama at midnight after a long night of singing and worshiping. While walking with her friend and her friend's son, they noticed a car with gawking white men kind of drive around them three times. The car came to an immediate stop, and seven white men jumped out carrying knives and guns and walked towards them. Herbert Lovett, the oldest of the group at the age of 24 years, and an army private shouted at them to stop. He claimed that he was looking for Taylor, who he accused of outing a white boy in a different part of cutting a white boy in a different part of town. To corroborate his story, he added that the sheriff, George Gamble, had sent out his group to find the alleged assailant, Taylor. The rest of the men agreed that she was the assailant, and pointing his gun to Taylor's head, Lovett shoved her into the car. Helpless, you know, her friends just kind of stood there and watched with horror as they took her away. And they had promised that they would bring her back. They just wanted to bring her to the sheriff's office. So the car drove a few miles before pulling over in the woods. Taylor was forced out of the car and commanded to take off her rags or be shot dead. She complied, sobbing, and begged them to let her go back to her husband and baby. Lovett ignored her cries, of course, asked her to lay down on a shirt, jacket he laid on the floor. And while the men took up their clothes, Taylor kind of just lay there in horror. Hovering over Taylor, he said, quote, act like you do with your husband, I'll cut your damn throat. Lovett would be the first of six men to rape Taylor that evening. After they violated her for hours, one of them helped her get dressed, tied her handkerchief over her eyes, and shoved her back into the car. They drove off and dropped her off, on the side of a road. After they left, she took off the handkerchief and started her long journey back home. And then the third and last vignette is in a more recent story. I'm sure many of you remember this. During the height of Black Lives Matter in 2014, 2015, there was a story of an Oklahoma police officer, Oklahoma City police officer. Mm-hmm. So basically during this period, news surfaced about Oklahoma City police officer Daniel Holtzclaw, a 30-year-old cop who was accused of serial sexual assault and abuse of black women between December 2013 to June 2014. Holtzclaw specifically targeted black women from a majority black and poor part of Oklahoma City, people he knew was vulnerable and couldn't fight back. He used his power as a gun-wielding police officer to do background checks on black women with outstanding warrants and criminal records, and through this process forced them into sexual acts by threatening to arrest them and prosecute, arrest them and jail them. his victims included women as young as teenagers, to women in their 50s. Upon his arrest, he was charged with 36 counts of sexual abuse offenses, including first and second degree rape, sexual battery, forcible oral sodomy, and stalking. Hotzclaw's defense, of course, relied on racist descriptions of his victims as liars, criminals, and junkies. Terms meant to discredit and dehumanize these women, a strategy, of course, we commonly know used to dismiss charges by black people, right? And we've seen this over and over again in the Black Lives Matter movement. However, through the organizing efforts of local anti-racist and anti-rape groups, with the support of the larger Black Lives Matter movement that kind of gave a national platform to these to this case, Hustler's case reached a national spotlight. And due to the pressure of the movement, along with the local organizing that happened, the jury was forced to deliver justice in 2015 in the face of clear evidence of systematic abuse after a relatively short trial. And he was charged on 16 of the 36 charges and sentenced to 263 years in prison. Of course, they decided to make him serve it simultaneously so he could get out as soon as 30 years from now. But Holtzclaw is merely one example of the largest systematic abuse of black women, of women in general by police officers in the US. I wanted to highlight this a little bit before I move on to the other part of the talk. A year-long Associated Press investigation of sexual misconduct by law enforcement discovered that nearly 1,000 cops had lost their badges over a six-year period for sodomy, rape, and other sexual assaults, as well as sex crimes such as child pornography. Now, this number was shocking to me because we know how cops get away with so much. So I was happy to see that statistic. It's horrific, but it's also, you know, something had been done. However, we know that for every one of these cases, hundreds more go unpunished. The statistic does not actually include data from larger and highly policed states like California and New York. So we know it's barely scratching the surface of how, you know, a deeply systematic system of sexual violence by police officers against poor black women, children, et cetera. These three vignettes that I just described across different historical periods tell us a critical story, which is that from the very founding of the United States to the Me Too era, violence and particularly sexual violence against black women has been a central feature of anti-black racism. Sexual violence against black women and accusations of sexual violence against black men have been a ruling class tool of repression and terrorization of black populations in order to more effectively control us. Despite this reality, sexual violence against black women is still under discussed in historical writing, as Angela Davis kind of polemicizes in her writing, Women, Race, and Class. I mean, that was in the 70s, but I think we can still say that while there's been a growth of literature with like black feminist theories, and it's still something that is under discussed. It's under discussed in historical writings on slavery. At best and at worst, black women have been hypersexualized and depicted as welcoming the sexual advances of white men. Angela Davis describes this misrepresentation, what happens when black women and white men, she basically says what happened between black women and white men was not just like sexual relations or, you know, racial misogynation, but rather a systemic tool of sexual violence shaped by, you know, power differences and rooted in a slave economy. So precisely because sexual violence has been a central feature of black women's oppression in the US, black women were the first in this country to organize against sexual violence against women, the earliest record of which was in the mid to late 1800s. And I'll get back to that later. I don't know if folks have read this book. It really kind of like, it was mind blowing when I first read it, because we, you know, talk about women's oppression, we talk about racism, but I think there's something, the way she discusses and highlights like the systematic rape of enslaved women really puts things into perspective why black feminists talk about the need to have an intersectional analysis of our oppression, right? That you cannot just talk about gender, you cannot just talk about race. There's something about both, the interlocking of both of these oppressions that produces a qualitatively different different experience and political reality. So she you know, said enslaved women have been historically described as house servants. That is, slaves who held the position of a maid, a cook, or a mammy for white children. However, this is inaccurate. Enslaved women, like their male counterparts in the Deep South, were also field workers. Mm-hmm. During the mid-1800s, 7 out of 8 slaves, whether male or female, were field workers. Mm-hmm. Girls, just as much as boys, were sent to work on the plantation, pick cotton, harvest tobacco, and cut sugarcane once they came of age. Because of your position as property, not human beings, enslaved women were not afforded the so-called benefits of womanhood that middle and ruling class white women were given during that period. When the international slave trade was abolished 2 decades into the 19th century, slave owners became concerned about a shortage in slaves, which would devastate the booming cotton industry that they were profiting from. They therefore shifted your attention more towards natural reproduction to the means of replenishing and increasing the slave population. And enslaved women's reproductive ability then became a significant focus of slave owners. The more fertile an enslaved woman was, and the more children she bore, the more valuable she was considered. This, of course, did not change black women's value or conditions of labor. Rather, enslaved women were merely considered breeders, as Davis put it. Quote, animals whose monetary value could be precisely calculated in terms of the ability to multiply their numbers. This reproduction process, like slave labor, would be forced and cruel. And when enslaved children were born, they would be ripped apart.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.